Guru Nation, welcome to episode 792 of Random Musings from the Clinical Trials Guru. In this episode, I interview Gevorg Stepanian and Hetman Shay. Hetman is a industry outsider, but he's engineer, developer, software. He's focused on tech, and we get an outsider's perspective on clinical research because he's been playing around with a couple solutions with his business partner, Gevorg Stepanian. Both of their LinkedIns are underneath. Gev's been in academic medical research for almost 2 decades now, maybe 1.5 decades. He's got a lot of experience from the academic medical center's perspective across the board, from coordinating to budgets to literally everything. We kind of walk through certain pain points in research. I chime in from a private site perspective. There's actually a lot in common from the AMCs and the private sites, and why research still hasn't adopted tech. So check both of their LinkedIn profiles underneath this episode when you get a chance. And also, really quickly, wanted to give a shout out to my sponsors. The first one is Inato. So thank you, Inato, for making it easier to get studies for your site. I'm on there absolutely free. You don't need to pay anything. I actually have to go on there right now and tighten up one of my study submissions for a PI that I'm trying to get a new study on. And cost me nothing. It benefits me in the sense that I can get more studies to my pipeline for my site. So it's really good. They don't get involved in the budgets or contracts or anything. Link in the show notes. Next sponsor is Creo. Creo is another website slash cloud-based software system that I use for my site. It's a CTMS, it's an eSource, it's an eReg, it's a financing tool, it's a e-signature, it's an e-consent. I mean, it's really everything. And I'm on it right now, actually, looking to see if my site, because I'm working from home today, if my site is screening patient or not. And I can actually tell that it hasn't happened yet, but hopefully soon. But it's an amazing tool for site directors and site owners. So check it out. Link in the show note. Hope you enjoy this episode with Gev and Hetman. And I'll talk to you later. Bye bye.
But then when you started talking, it made sense. Like everything made sense, you know? Like, and it's free. And I'm like, this guy doesn't belong in academia. This dude is in the wrong place.
All right, we're ready. We're
But
recording.
everything's for a reason, I think. You were there for a reason.
It gave me a lot of experience and
Yeah.
a lot of value from the leaders that I've had there, to be honest. So
Yeah.
I don't think I've been in academia that long without those people.
Yeah. Where'd you go to school? UCLA too?
I went to Harvard. Yeah,
Oh, you went
undergrad.
to Harvard?
Yeah.
Holy crap.
And then met Gav at UCLA for business school.
Oh, you guys both went to business school.
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah.
Are we shooting?
We're live.
Oh, cool. Let's just keep with that. Like, so this is Gavin Hetman. They're here from LA. They came all the way to Yuma Clinical Trials. There's a lot of collaborations I think we can have. And how did you discover you weren't at SOS, but like you saw some of our footage and you reached out like right after SOS.
Yeah, I think you're, at least in my opinion, one of the more influential influencers in, especially on LinkedIn, in the
Thank
clinical
you.
trials space. So naturally, I was following a lot of your posts, and so I saw your posts about, outreach and collaborations, and I thought this would be a good
Okay.
opportunity.
And we're gonna get into your background because UCLA, AMC, but also business school, and you guys both, that makes sense. That's where you guys met. So you're from engineer development, but your background before that's biochem. So you're able to kind of, within life sciences, you're able to kind of connect those two things together because in a way you're using both backgrounds. Maybe more so right now the developer one,
Yeah.
but it doesn't hurt to have the biochem background either.
I mean, it makes understanding some of the terms a little easier. Of course, I'm still 20 years away from my undergraduate learnings, but there's some things that I see and I can go, you know what? I can go and do a little bit of research and learn about it.
He says, "20 year exam. I think me too. I graduated in 04.
Yeah, 07 for me.
Okay. Yeah. And I didn't go to Harvard. I went to U of A, Arizona. But Harvard, I mean, that's amazing. And then so working with someone from academia, like you've come across, I mean, in your time at AMC, I mean, you do their budgets. What do you do? Like data management? I mean, so, you kind of do everything.
Yeah. So when I started off as a research associate and then clinical research coordination, it was basically a full service CRC, meaning, you know, soup to nuts, regulatory data management, fund management, and patient management. At UCLA, it's primarily everything related to finance and Medicare coverage analysis and really just managing a team of finance there. So I haven't done the clinical research coordination much lately, but we still collaborate a lot with the departments and the divisions that do. And so that's still quite fresh in my mind.
What are like some of the biggest pain points? Because you're still there, right? Mm-hmm. What are some of the biggest pain points that you've experienced, whether they're currently or, I mean, have any of them been solved since you've started?
I think UCLA specifically is unique in that it's, you know, at least the leadership that I have there and the dean's office there is very, you know, forward facing and tech enabling. And so, for example, we have informatics team within UCLA that really drives a lot of technology adoption and making sure that makes it easier for the research infrastructure there. But, you know, it's a massive institution and it has its own challenges when it comes to, you know, whether it be bureaucracy or policies and procedures. You know, you're interacting with many different people. And so that creates its own natural challenges. As a research coordinator at UCSF, it's also a massive institution. I think just generally with most coordinators, you're, you know, buried head down, just trying to get through the day, study after study. And when I was there, it was just mostly paper. So like that added a different element.
And you were surprised by what you, both of you guys, by what you saw. We use Creo. Mm-hmm. Shout out to Creo, by the way. We might have some opportunities later as well to discuss with Creo, but you were surprised by the e-source that we used.
Yeah.
What was surprising?
For me, at least, my experience has always been your source documentation is the electronic health record. And then if you have something that's outside of that, it's the case report form. And that's generally been some coupling of paper. And then if it's in the EMR, it stays in the EMR. I think it was pretty refreshing to see sites adopting technology and really developing source through that, which likely, you know, makes it easier for the coordinator, but also reduces the error level when it comes to transmitting that data. So that was pretty interesting to see.
And at UCLA, they're not using Creo, right? They're using...
No, the UCLA uses a CTMS called Encore, and the e-regulatory is Florence.
And then their source?
The source is Epic, essentially. Epic
so it's EHR. Just the EHR. Yeah. Like the conventional, I think for AMCs, academic medical centers, that's conventional.
Yeah, and it's a combination of either it stays in Epic and it's monitored in Epic, or you export it, redact it, and keep it in the source binder, whether it's eBinder redacted. Or regular.
So when I monitored another UC, I won't give more hints, that nothing was redacted. I mean, everything was printed. Like they printed it from their EHRs mm-hmm. in a folder. Each patient had their own binder for the monitors, but nothing was redacted. Mm. I was surprised by that. I'm like, usually, like, you know, because I'm over here scanning the documents as a CRA. I'm scanning them.
Right.
I'm going to be sending them to my lead CRA to look at. You know, you would expect them to be redacted.
That was my training when I was a CRC. Obviously, I don't document management now for UCLA.
Yeah.
Stay on the finance side, so I don't deal with patient records, but... That is it. That was what I was trained to do, at least.
Hmm. The beauty about Creo and like eSource, the way we have it, is you give monitors access to it. Mm-hmm. So technically, you don't have to download anything. You can if you want to, like we showed you, but you don't have to. So technically, it doesn't have to be redacted because it's not leaving that system. And this is Creo's official policy on it, actually, and they have like the documentation to help sites like the SOP. It doesn't have to be redacted. And I've heard the same thing from Viva, and they obviously know what they're doing. I mean, they get several billion dollars behind their market cap, so maybe the redacting thing is just extra caution, or maybe it has to do with like transferring the data around and it's not in the same place like where it originated from. Maybe that's where that comes in.
Or it's just the view only access, so it can't be extracted out.
That, yeah, that too.
Yeah, I mean, I'd be curious, you know, it seems like UCLA even is adopting remote monitoring strategies, you know, giving access to Epic and, you know, combination of a box drive or whatever it is. You know, are you guys, how do you feel about remote monitoring? Is that something that...
We like it. I mean, we have, like, you heard me talk to the monitor today on the phone. For one of our studies, I think they alternate every other visit's remote, then every other one's in person.
Mm-hmm.
You kind of miss them, like when they do come around. Like, I'm not gonna lie, the remote sounds really good on paper, but you do lose like a bit of a relationship. Like, it's different when he comes, you know, like you guys are here. Mm-hmm. I mean, it's different than doing a Zoom. Even if we were to do a Zoom, it's different.
You're spending the whole day with a monitor.
Yeah, basically. And like in the flesh, you can't hide.
Mm-hmm.
You can't mute yourself on Zoom. You know, turn off your camera for 5 seconds, come back on. Like, you're there. There's more of a, I think, like structure to, or so, there's more reality to your interaction that carries forward later.
Yeah, and I remember all of my monitors, to be honest. I mean, like, you get into conversations, they would always ask about your family and with my girlfriend, now wife at the time. It's just like, it goes beyond. So you build good relationships with them. And I think that has been something that, you know, has been important for us to at UCLA, or at least for my team to work on. It's just like going fully remote. Before this, you were such a close-knit team. And then now you have to really work on rebuilding that.
Yeah.
I'm guessing that's the same with relationships with sponsors.
Yeah, I think the sponsors know that on-site matters, because I think you get more compliance when your monitor comes versus when they're just going to do another Zoom with you.
That's interesting.
There's more consequences, I think, as a site to when, you know, I know my monitor's coming, I can't escape, versus it's just a Zoom.
Easier, like, to ignore an email summary.
Yeah, or even a Zoom. Like, okay, well, we'll do it, and then the Zoom's over, right? It's harder to hide from, like, in person.
Fair enough.
So there's a reason why it's here, but a lot of inefficiencies in this industry. Have you ever visited a private site, like a non-AMC site before?
Yes, I have.
Okay. Were they just pure paper?
Pure paper, oncology, disparate sites. So they had multiple clinic locations and a lot of traveling. Actually, a couple of those type of institutions.
Oncology's oncology. The one that's different.
Yeah, it's a different beast. And especially when the coordinator has to travel, you have a lot of IP that needs to travel and have your visit. So, you know, it makes it a lot more complicated in that sense.
And oncology's the only one where standard of care translates to the study.
Yes. So instead of having a fully research paid budget, oftentimes you do have a mixed billing budget where some of it goes to the patient's insurance. And that goes back to my current role and determining, you know, what can Medicare pay for or will pay for versus what needs to be directed to the research account.
That's right. And that's a big issue in that world. Like in our world here, it doesn't matter. But in the AMC world, that's like a huge...
Keep it that way.
Yeah, we will. I mean, I think that's why sponsors prefer.
Yeah.
This stuff started in the 80s, like the adoption of private sites. Mm-hmm. It really started in the 80s. I think IQVIA, which was Quintiles back then, made it possible for sponsors to not just rely solely on academic medical centers, but hey, Dr. So-and-so at, you know, the mom and pop clinic in Yuma will manage their process for you and you pay us as the CRO. I think that's really what provided this long tail of opportunity, which the private sites usually outwork the AMCs for the most part, like on a typical study.
And it's really important for the diversity of providers as well, especially when it comes to what can the AMC provide and how ingrained are they in the community and what type of advertising outreach do they do. That, I think, you know, it's markedly different, as we talked about today, from what you guys do versus what AMCs do mm-hmm. in that space. So different landscape.
It's almost outreach. Like different worlds, but I think there's certain commonalities, because I've monitored some academic medical centers as well, so that's my only experience with them, but it was a sustained like 2 maybe 3 years of doing it at 2 different
AMCs. I won't ask whether it was good or bad.
I mean, to me it was, I was unimpressed with like their process, like how they run things, but it got the job done and patients were served and nothing bad happened. So I mean, they're getting the, it's serving a purpose.
Yeah,
but I've noticed similar pain points that coordinators share, whether it's at an AMC or at a private site.
Absolutely.
And they're usually around the same couple of verticals. You've got patient recruitment, which at AMCs, academic medical centers, most coordinators don't actively go recruit patients, but they're responding to leads coming to them. Same thing what we have developed here mm-hmm. at UMA Clinical Trials. Like we have Patient Ace, which is something we started, and leads every hour. Every hour, a couple of leads. So similar problem. You know, AMC or private site, coordinator has to respond to leads. That same coordinator's got to answer queries. That same coordinator's mm-hmm. got to get patients consented, make sure the PI follows what they need to do, schedule the visits. I mean, those are just the beginnings of the pain points. I think it gets much deeper than that. But what are some of the pain points you've noticed at AMC?
You know, as a coordinator, I think there is some element of simplicity when it comes to recruitment, because you're in a practice of, say, 10 cardiologists. And they're all aware of the same clinical trial. They all are aware of the inclusion, exclusion. All of them share the same EMR, so I can pre-screen all of them at the same time. But again, that just, you know, exponentially increases the number of pre-screenings I have to do and the number of investigators mm-hmm. I have to engage with and track around and, you know, patients I have to coordinate with. I think that was the biggest challenge when it comes to recruitment. You know, I don't know personally, at least this was like a decade ago, how useful radio advertisement or paper advertisement was. And my time was an Instagram advertisement.
Right.
Most of those leads were coming from, you know, I'm seeing this patient today, or, hey, you're going to see this patient today. Can I come with you? Or can you present the study to them?
Right.
A lot of the challenges was just the workflows in place. There are a lot of, you know, policies in place and technical restrictions, logins, whatever it is in a larger institution that a coordinator has to go through on top of whatever the sponsor is requiring them to
on
do.
On top of what the sponsor,
So I think that was what really makes it difficult for a coordinator to be able to manage a day-to-day, at least my experience.
Yeah, and private sites do. I mean, less so. There's less bureaucracy, less red tape. Although the bigger private sites tend to...
They have to start creating
act that. More like AMC too. So what about tech? Like, Hetman, you're an engineer and developer. You must be looking at this stuff and seeing opportunities everywhere you look, but it's a lot harder than it seems.
Yeah, of course. So in tech, or more specifically engineering, in bigger organizations, there's always like a lot of bureaucracy, and there's always folks who will say there's got to be a better way to do this. And so sometimes the systems that are put in place are intended to facilitate things like not going wrong. So they say, okay, well, here are the guardrails. There's something went wrong before, so now we have to like bracket a problem so that it never happens again. Mm-hmm. And so that's some of the causes for bureaucracy. Obviously, for a big company with a lot of years of history, that happens more and more and more. And so what you get is a little bit of you get a little bit of friction within the system if you're trying to do something, because there's so many people saying, well, no, you can't do this, you can't do that. And that exists not just in engineering or, you know, in aerospace, which is where I spent most of my career, mm-hmm. but other industries too, healthcare, you know, in talking to Giv, see that a bunch, a lot of inefficiencies. And I'm sure there are people with good intentions putting up intentionally, like guardrails intentionally, so that, you know, things don't fall out, but
right.
Or go like, you know,
that's
sideways.
A good way to explain it. Mm-hmm. That would actually explain why the bigger organizations have more bureaucracy. It's just legacy rules they had in place, and mistakes happen. This is their CAPA plan, and now it's like part of the SOP. And just, it makes sense. The longer you've been around, the more of these things you've come across. Yeah. And now you just keep adding to your procedures. Whereas a smaller site maybe hasn't, like, we're only 2 years old. Three, depends how you count. We haven't really had, thankfully, any major issues.
And if you do, I think, you know, you're able to address it with your staff mm-hmm. pretty quickly. Whereas
in real time, yeah.
An organization like UCLA, when you have tens of thousands of staff,
wow.
You know, so like having workflows and policies in place that everyone signs off on is really important just to keep that engine rolling. Otherwise, if someone derails, you know, first of all, you have to identify that it derailed. And second of all, who did it and how to fix it.
Mm-hmm. Do you think like a workflow, do you think we'll ever have like automated workflow with AI helping a coordinator during their day? Like, do you think we're close to this?
I mean, in a sense, there are a lot of technologies helping those things, right? So
there's like Creo will tell you, hey, start this visit, it's at 9.
Yeah,
when you hit start, then it goes through, if you programmed it well, what you have to do.
Yeah, I know. I mean, scheduling assistants are one thing. Mm-hmm. I know, you know, non-clinical trial related, but I know sites that use sort of marketing and sort of lead generation tools for patient tracking stuff that works for them. But in the sense of like traditional clinical trials, you have companies like DeepSix AI that help you find patients within your institution. I know a lot of AMCs mm-hmm. use them. You have EMRDDC software.
That's a SoCal guy too.
Yeah.
The guy who created yeah. that. Mm-hmm. And Deep Lens. They're both California guys. Oh.
Mm-hmm. And you know, you have EMR to EDC technologies that are helping mm-hmm. transmit. I don't know how much those are being used, but the technology's out there. So there are technologies that are geared for helping coordinators. When it comes to a bigger site, it's how fast can you adopt those technologies is the biggest challenge. Being able to get through the compliance and IT and security and adoption phase takes quite a while, just because you have to jump through a lot of hurdles. Mm-hmm. And is it worth for that organization to do that? I'm sure, you know, they're making different decisions on that. I know UCLA tests certain things to see what is optimal for them and what they want to use. And I'm sure other institutions do the same trade-offs too.
Do you think that, like, with let's say a day in the life of a coordinator, you've probably seen areas at UCLA or maybe when you visited another site, things that could be standardized. Do you ever think we'll reach standardization in research? Because that's one of the biggest complaints from outsiders who want to start, let's say, start a site. I wish there was like a standard for how to find a doctor and how to negotiate a contract with them. And then how to find my first study, where to apply. Shout out to our sponsor, Inato. But where to apply? I mean, there's a lot of like vendors trying to standardize certain verticals, but there's no like standardization, like blessing from the FDA or anyone else that says, hey, this is how it should be done. Do you think we will get that? I actually don't think that would be a good thing. I'm like a outsider on this school of thought. I actually don't think that'll be a good thing, because of like laziness breeds, well, complacency will breed laziness. And I think like you kind of need chaos to bring value to a system, to bring incremental changes.
Yeah. It's challenging. My experience, you know, you have a lot of conversations across institutions of similar, you know, size and structure. Like AMCs talk to AMCs, they use similar resources, right? You know, same CTMS or whatever.
Mm-hmm. Sure, but, like Red Cap, like you mentioned.
Yeah, but they're all structured differently, right? One of them could have, multiple outpatient or inpatient hospitals that they have to collaborate with. Or, you know, you could have, you know, your core location is in one state and then two other hospitals in another state, whereas another hospital is all located in one.
So even amongst them,
yeah, like decentralized team structure versus central, you know, clinical trials office, you know, all of them have those different nuances. And on top of that, they have different tolerances.
See, we'll never get standardization then. Yeah. All these people are just dreaming, I think.
You know, well, the reason I would argue against standardization is because you'd have to use like the lowest common denominator or the most strict site to do it against, because then you don't want them to be the outlier. That means if something is okay with them, it applies to everybody else. But that means you're creating more bureaucracy or more structure for all the other ones that may be, you know, unnecessary for them, but it was necessary for how this one institution is structured.
Right.
So I don't think we'll have, at least I don't believe.
Well, we're in the minority on this, because like we would be the bad guys. Because if you go on LinkedIn saying this, they're gonna cast you out of the.
I mean, I would love standardization. I think, you know, if there was a technology that would automate that process, at least in some sense, great. But I don't think institutions in themselves would.
Yeah. See, I think people who push for that are, they love it and they leave it there, but they don't look at where the road ends. The road ends in a few companies getting really big, monopolizing everything, and then protecting their moat so no more innovation happens. And I think it's that chaos that breeds the future incremental that turn into exponential growth.
Yeah, and in healthcare, it's not necessarily structured to encourage, I guess, technology development. I don't mean like drug development. Obviously, there's a lot of innovation there. I mean in more of the administrative sense of like technology to support an administration. Just because you have a lot of security protocols, a lot of sensitive data, proprietary things, and it's a generally very risk-averse industry. So my opinion, why one company grows and grows fast is because once, you know, they take years to validate with one company and then they can finally share that with the other companies, the other companies would feel safe to adopt that one. Mm-hmm. So, you know, that's why I think you have a few really big companies that are adopted a lot in the industry.
Yeah.
Are they the best technology? I don't know, but they're probably the most trusted.
Right? Probably not.
Yeah, but they're the most trusted. And so
they're the most good enough. And what was that book? Good to Great. The enemy of great is good enough.
Yeah.
I think that's kind of my issue with standardizing. I think it's just a pipe dream.
Yeah.
What do you think as a developer or engineer?
A standardization. Yeah. It's challenging for a couple of reasons. One is, and in engineering, there's a bunch of standards that you know, we try to comply with. ASTM, there's just a list of things that you need to benchmark against. The issue is when you're trying to be, when you're trying to move forward into the future, right? And you're trying to like, you know, adjust to things that are coming up. Maybe it's, in healthcare, it's like a disease that you're trying to fight, new drugs or vaccines, maybe those require a different approach, right? So if you have one thing fits all for things that have happened before,
yeah,
then it becomes harder to like adjust, because then how do you adjust to like, how do you like navigate, you know, like a tricky situation? Maybe like there isn't an authorization from.
And the incentives is not to explore, it's to continue to pursue what's already known.
Yeah. I mean, like one way to think about it is like, well, that, like at least from engineering, from my perspective, is that we definitely have procedures for things that need to happen in a certain direction. But if it goes like, you know, off script, what do you do? Right. And so you can have like standardization for like the majority of cases, but then kind of leave a little room for things that are off nominal, things that like kind of go haywire. Mm-hmm. And so to have just one monolith that just applies everywhere is kind of a not realistic. But if you have a way to get the major themes right and just go like make sure that all the fundamentals are kind of stacked correctly and are building towards something that works, then you can have like on the edges like a ways to like deal with edge cases and say, okay, well this is a little bit different, let's treat it with, you know, a different approach.
Yeah, I used to be, maybe this is a good way to end, and by the way, everyone go connect, you guys are both on LinkedIn, right?
Mm-hmm. Yep.
Go connect with Hatman and get on LinkedIn right now. If you're listening, It's in the show notes, both of their LinkedIns. I used to be on Clubhouse a lot during the
pandemic.
Yeah. Where Clubhouse kind of fell off. X took over. X copied their idea. We used to end this weekly clinical research room with, if you had a magic wand and change one thing about the industry, what would it be? So it'd be interesting to get both of your perspectives, one being from an academic medical institution, kind of a, so far your life's work within that realm, and the other from kind of an outsider developer engineer, which is becoming very popular right now in our space. So just to get that, your thoughts on this. If you had a magic wand and change one thing about the industry, what would it be?
I mean, this is pretty selfish. I think there's a lot of technology out there that could really benefit just the study coordinators or just the research staff in general. I get why it's so hard to adopt technology. But if I had a magic wand, that's what it would be, is just like adopt good technology faster.
Adopt good tech. The problem is, how do you know what's good and what's not?
Fine, just adopt tech faster.
like an openness. Like, be open to like accepting maybe different ways of doing what you used to do.
Yeah.
Like if you're used to paper, maybe a willingness to start, you know, typing on your keyboard or like writing on your iPad or something. I think that's the theme.
Make improvements, like gradual.
Yeah. Yeah. And it doesn't have to be like you're like not jumping in the deep end all the time. Maybe you can like take baby steps into like, you know, the shallow end of the pool and kind of work your way towards more and more tech focused approach.
Do you think this is the most backwards industry, like tech adopter laggards?
Well, I have a story. So when I was working in a lab in my group, my department, we had computers that still had, they were still running Windows 98. Can you imagine?
They're older than some of our coordinates.
Yeah. So. Oh my gosh. Yeah. Okay. And so they had these machines there because some of the software wouldn't run on any other machine. Like everything was obsoleted, right?
Yeah.
And so I always looked at that and thought, oh my gosh, this is like why didn't they just modernize it? Why didn't they just like figure out a way to get this this product or whatever they were using and just take it to, you know, 2015. You know what I mean? Like bring it forward 15 years. And a big challenge was that people were just used to it and they didn't want to touch it. It's like, if it's not broken, don't fix it. Just like, wow. Just use it as is. And you know, I think there's a better way. I think there's
because when they say it's not broken, don't fix it. But is that true? Like, is it broken?
So in this case, the way that they were doing, they were scanning wafers, right? And the way they were doing it, that process, if they were to change it, it would be broken. There was not really a better way of doing putting a wafer onto this machine than letting it get analyzed. But there are other ways of like approaching the problem. So instead of like a machine that like pulls it in and using a laser surf scan to review it, they ended up, they did do this, which is they ended up taking the wafer out completely and then imaging it with a camera. And so that camera was like, you know, more precise and it took like a lot less time and it didn't need Windows 98 to run. And it's just like, well, why didn't we do this sooner, right? So like there is inefficiencies across industries, even in industries like in engineering.
And that's costing ultimately like in an industry like healthcare, all of us, we're all patients at the end of the day too.
Yeah, exactly. Mm. So very similar to Gav, like it's the approach, like people like approaching technological adoption with so both, more open arms.
Yeah. Both on the same, interesting.
Yeah. I mean, I'm sure you know of coordinators who've done the job for a long time and
yes,
they have a process.
At the site in San Bernardino where you're maybe going to go one day, you'll see.
Yeah.
It's totally different than what we do here.
And they're in their routine. They have their way of doing things and you throw technology in the mix. Now they have to learn something new. All with an already busy day. I totally get it. Yep. Yeah. But ultimately it's like, how do you communicate the short term challenge with the long term benefit? That becomes challenging.
Yeah, it's definitely challenging. And if I were there, I would like to say it wouldn't be done that way, but it probably still would be because of who's working there.
Yeah. And it also is, you know, that person defines success of what they think is working or not, right? So unless the system says this isn't working for us, you know, they're going to continue to do what they do. And if you're a longtime coordinator, you're working for a department and it's good enough and well, no one's telling you to change. That's
a coordinator and a part owner of the site. So they've got a stake in the business outcomes, but to them, the outcome that they're looking for is this is the least headache option currently.
And that's how they define success. Yeah.
Yeah. Whereas some of the other stakeholders are like, well, a little more headache for you would be better for us in the long run. But the key word is for you.
Yeah.
Because they're the ones doing the work, not me.
Yeah.
Here, we had no choice. Everyone started because I chose Creo. This is how we're going to do it. When you work here, you're going to do podcasts with business leaders in the community. Like, there's no other alternative.
But you're also engaged with the community and looking for efficiencies and new technology that could help your team do better. Mm-hmm. You know, I think that's, from a large institution perspective, there's one of the institution's willingness, and then there's also how effective are they to get their staff to buy into that technology or solution or workflow or whatever it is. Any change is challenging, especially in a big organization.
It's a complicated thing. I think this will unravel this in future episodes. Yeah. We've got a couple future podcasts coming up too.
Happy to.
So thank you guys both. Gavin Hatham from LinkedIn. You could both connect with them right now. Their LinkedIn is underneath this video and in the show notes. Thank you guys both very much.
Thanks for having us.
Bye-bye.